Okay, so you were talking about the fact that your name was on the indictment.
My name is, there were two indicted together, David and another fellow. And Judge Baloney handled the case. It was prominently pictured and displayed, not only in Willamette Week, but in the other papers. The nature of his objection was, I think, well explained, both by him and people understood that this war was a morally offensive war, and he would not fight in it, although he well could have fought in others. And that wouldn't qualify him for CO status. And thus, he was found guilty and sent to jail for 2 years. Went to Lompoc with the other fellow, whose name I have forgotten for the moment. And there were problems. You'd have to talk to his mother, Jerry Newhall, to get them, or maybe to him. He, by the way, is head of the English department at Occidental in California now. About that, because they were then changed to McNeil, then a federal prison, from Lompoc, because there was some trouble. And I'm not sure what the trouble was. They may have been thought to be troublemakers, and then and they're therefore removed from Lompoc, which was a little looser place, and sent to McNeil for the rest of their period of confinement. Well, that was one of the more dramatic, from an intellectual standpoint, of the resistance to the war. But there were many, many others. And Lance Montauk, who occasionally still contacts Lezak from Reed, Lance Montauk was ordered to report, and this is the way they usually set themselves up, set up the case, report for induction. And Lance Montauk reported for induction for his physical examination. They would all line up and they would be asked to take a step forward and then take the oath of allegiance to the United States Army, or whatever it is, enter into the military service. And if they didn't take the step forward, then they didn't. And at some point before that, they had to take the physical exam to see whether they were physically qualified to then step forward. And that occurred right down here at there's a bookstore there now, across from where the used to be the Georgia Pacific building. It's a standard building now. And across the street, well, that may be gone now when they built Pioneer Place. The Looking Glass bookstore is down the street. I think that may be gone now, where they used to have the military selective service examining station, and where they entered into military duty by raising their hand. And anyway, he reported down for his physical exam. And he appeared, and he was wearing two hip height boots. One filled with red paint, and the other filled with blue to the top. To a point where, and it turned out the marshals later smilingly remarked, oil-based paint. These full-length hip boots filled to the top in each side, one with one color paint and one with the other. Red, and I believe it was blue, not green, paint. Oil-based paint. And the doctor said, well, all right, take your clothes off so we can examine you. whereupon Montauk took off the boots, spilling the paint all over everywhere, thoroughly obstructing the physical examination. And the doctor's saying, oh my goodness gracious, well now what do we do? Well, he was arrested. And the call to us, what do we charge him with? And oh, Lezak and the rest of us saw this escalating into a major demonstration because there were many other people awaiting their physical exam. Mm-hmm. And it had all the hallmarks of a very planned and large-scale event about to happen outside the Selective Service headquarters there, examining station. And so we thought long and hard and said, well, what are you doing? Well, we're cleaning up this mess, this paint. And we said, aha, a misdemeanor damaging government property. And so he was charged with the misdemeanor of damaging government property, arrested by the marshals, and taken off. But in taking him away, one had to clean up the mess. And it being oil-based, turpentine all over him and the floor. And there was a certain snickering by the marshals as he was wiped down with turpentine to remove the paint. Well, anyway, it came on, and he eventually was convicted of this misdemeanor, if I recall. And the sentence was, of course, for a misdemeanor, wasn't very much. And the problem removed. Well, there were lots of problems that arose in a, shall I say, a less humorous way, because what happened was that the Selective Service boards were civilian folks, not particularly well-trained, well-meaning, incredibly well-meaning, and indeed most of them, at least from what we saw, pretty understanding of the situation of many of these people, the people coming before them, who by this time the war had taken on a very ugly turn. Mm-hmm. The casualties were mounting, the bombing raids were occurring in Cambodia, the progress toward any kind of a solution, I mean there were 500,000 men, Americans, in Vietnam.
What were your personal feelings about the war at the time?
Well, I'm not entirely sure. I was disturbed that this was an instance of executive war, and I hadn't seen that much before. I had come from a period from the Second World War, where there were very bad people, and everybody served, and it was very successful in the sense that the United States won the war in all sorts of ways, and the peace afterward, the Truman Plan, and so forth, and even the Korean War, of course, which wasn't a war, which was a police action. It was never a declaration. And I felt that was the right thing to do. I never cared for MacArthur. I thought he was an emperor. He'd been exactly the right man to govern Japan after the war, a peacock, and an emperor who'd been out there a greater part of his life, just the right man to impose a military occupation in Japan and write them, interestingly enough, a constitution said they shall not make war or shall not have a military force. Mm-hmm. And then the Vietnam War, never a war, again, executive war, I felt that I was, if I wanted to stay with the government, duty-bound to carry out, if you take the Queen's shilling, you do the Queen's business. And I felt duty-bound to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I frankly didn't have a lot of the feelings that Sidney did, that he could do more to help inside, as he did, by defusing many, many, many instances of the police and the and the students. He and Greg Wolf was then the president of Portland State, and you know, they had the barricades up there, and Frank Ivancy and the tactical squad. I remember David Newhall Sr. just crying when they came through and bashed heads and tore down the tents and the obstructions and the walls and injured a fair number of people who were objecting to the war. And Sidney did an enormous amount at smoothing relations, making it possible for people to come and do their thing, that is to say, not step forward, be charged without violence, without a lot of the kinds of actions that occurred elsewhere. On the other hand, Gwyther and Morgan. I had no trouble with Gwyther and Morgan. Morgan had been the president of the student body at the University of Oregon. David Gwyther was his friend, and they acted together in their mock trials. And in Eugene, and they were planning elsewhere. And the Eugene board, Selective Service Board, would have a meeting. They burst into the meeting, placed everyone under arrest, forced them to stand against the walls, and charged them with murder, locked the door so that they could not leave, and conducted a mock trial in which they, the board members, were found guilty of murder and to be sentenced. Obviously, the board meeting did not continue. They planned to do this and made some plans to do this to other board meetings. They were going to become, it was thought, circuit riding vigilantes for stopping Selective Service Board meetings through these trial techniques. We indicted them, grand jury indicted them, for obstruction of the Military Selective Service Act of 1940. And they were tried, and Nels Peterson was one of their defense counsel.
Hmm.
And I'm trying to think who the other was. That the description of their intrusion, and there was some pushing and shoving of the board members by them. There were no personal injuries or violence in an extended form of violence. No guns, as I recall. No weapons shown. The trial was dramatic in that the board members were the witnesses and recounted exactly what happened. And indeed, one of the accounts was so articulate and so well said that I copied from the transcript, that testimony of it, because it told the story in about a page or two, and told it very well and very accurately. and the reason in the Ninth Circuit brief. And the decision was upheld.
They were found guilty.
They were found guilty, affirmed. The reason I mention that section of the brief, which copied the part of the transcript and told the story, was that shortly before I retired, there was a petition for a pardon by Gwaether. And Steve Pfeiffer, the assistant who got then, still there, who got that request, came to me and asked if I remembered anything of Gwaether and Morgan. And I said, yes, I can tell you exactly what happened, because the transcripts now had long gone. They had been returned, and the records, there weren't any, except that brief. That brief that had the description of what happened. And I said, they want a pardon. Would someone like to have an explanation? Because they had given explanations in their pardon, which were not all that detailed, and I could understand that. And I said, here's the brief, and here's the transcript. And Ed Pfeiffer said, oh my goodness, because I still had a copy of those briefs, which, by the way, are in the Oregon Historical Society now. Mm-hmm. And he copied that and used that and said, this is what happened. And I think the request for a pardon was denied. This was a Lezak, I made the closing argument, and Lezak made the rebuttal. And the reason I remember the rebuttal was his use of the words. And he did, because they had painted themselves, I think, as college boys of high motive, and in a sense they were. And their actions were quite something else in taking over that office, board meeting, and the rest. And he said, Lezak said of them, and next it will be Jack Boots. And the reference was entirely clear that these were the stormtroopers, and that Lezak, a Jew, was in a position to know something about that, and that he saw here the analogy very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a quiet moment after those arguments, and they were found guilty. I never cared for Morgan, and I still don't. An egotistical, I know what's right. Not just college boy, but Gwaether, a bit different. A quieter, taller, bigger guy. But a more reflective or thoughtful kind of guy. But they did their time. They got out. Morgan's still in his family's lumber business down there somewhere in... and Gwaether, I don't know so much about. I know he worked in a coffee shop down there and may still be, for all I know. But Gwaether and Morgan, a very dramatic bit of... legal resistance, as it were, our legal involvement. But the involvement was much, much, much more, because you see, the Selective Service Board in San Francisco became known as one who would grant exemptions very easily. And so everybody who was resisting the war or wanted a deferment was transferring their Selective Service Boards to their addresses and everything else to San Francisco, with the thought that they would easily get a deferment and avoid the war. Gus Solomon had very strong feelings about this. For him, in my opinion, it became an attack upon the judicial system, because what would happen is that the cases that were generated in San Francisco were among the most difficult in terms of the selective service law, and drawn out and intentionally filed and clogging the judicial calendars with the thought of bringing the judiciary to a halt. Nothing short of that. By clogging the calendars, raising all the defenses that then, and this was an instance, there was a publication which became known as the Selective Service Law Reporter, which was a very fine reporter. And we now have, for instance, the Environmental Law Reporter copied on the same idea, that this was the best lawyering you could lay your hands on, and it was a national compendium and source for selective service law in resisting the application of the act, resisting the draft. And it was good. And the lawyers were good. It's an example of a statute enacted for one time, the Second World War, which when tough, good, legal minds go to work on it, simply fractures, simply comes apart, simply becomes useless. Mm-hmm. And it was their intention to do exactly that, to use the law to stop the draft by creating and raising innumerable defenses, which were really quite remarkable. And hundreds of cases were backing up in the U.S. District Court. Thousands of cases were backing up in the U.S. District Court in San Francisco. Now, there were plenty here. Gus Solomon was assigned by the circuit to sit in San Francisco on those cases, many
of them. Oh, boy.
And went down there, and this, remember, is the fastest gavel in the West.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what the Honolulu paper said of him, and that's what he said of himself occasionally. And a man who, regardless of his sympathies about the war, his feelings about the respect for the statute and the law, and his duty to carry it out, were not only being challenged personally, but that the judiciary itself in San Francisco was being made the goat. And he took enormous personal offense at that they were trying to destroy the system that he felt very strongly about as a judge, as a citizen. And he went down, and they would work 7 days a week. They would work Sundays. And he would send the lawyers a list of 100 selective service cases that would be called Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. And they were. And by 5 o'clock that day, they were disposed of.
100?
At least, maybe 200.
Wow.
And what happened was that Tommy Honk, among others, an assistant U.S. attorney from Portland, Oregon, went down there to help try cases for the U.S. attorney in San Francisco, and there were others, help try these cases in front of this judge. And there was Colonel Ike, E-I-C-H, and I'm not sure, Eichenberger, I'm not quite sure. Anyway, he was the liaison and worker for the Army with the Selective Service Boards as they pertain to Oregon cases. And there were other similar persons there. And what they would do is a case would be called. The government would say, ready. The defendant would say, ready. And the judge would say, where is the file? And the assistant would have called on Sunday morning, and the colonel would have got the records. And from the board and the necessary support And that record would be produced that Sunday morning, and the case would proceed. And the witnesses would be obtained, and this went on all day Sunday and all day Monday, Tuesday, 7 days a week. And thousands of cases were disposed of within a month or two. And this whole saga was remarkable. And Gus had a great deal to do with that, for ill or not, in seeing that those cases, and our office, through Hawk and the Colonel and some others, helped provide the liaison and support for this judicial juggernaut that was coming at this problem. So yes, we had a lot to do with seeing that those cases, and then Gus would come back here and do much the same with not quite as big a backlog. But he did remarkable things. What he found was, for instance, that the Jehovah's Witnesses could not serve. But they could not be quite COs either for some reason. And what he found was that they would take the order of the court. And so Gus, when he discovered that there was a Jehovah's Witness who would respond to the orders of the court, would simply order him to go and do alternative service.
Mm-hmm.
And this was not the government doing it. It was the Lord doing it, acting through the judge. And they did. And so he disposed of, he'd say, all right, you do alternative service for the Red Cross or something for 2 years. And then they'd go off, and the problem resolved itself. I was not directly in a lot of these cases, but I was in many of them. And and many of them would be the record before the Selective Service Board. And the question was whether they had complied with what they were supposed to do. And they'd write nasty people. People would write nasty letters to the board and call them all kinds of names and things. But the legal question became whether they had not obeyed or what they were supposed to do, or just called somebody a lot of names. These cases absorbed an enormous amount of time and effort. At least two assistants full-time, and then it became at least three, devoted to the technicalities, and there were enormous technicalities in the defenses that could be raised,
mm-hmm.
often properly. Often the board had screwed up,
mm-hmm.
and it had to go back to the board to get straightened out, and then it did, and then they did it again. The resistance to the war itself, we had something to do with that too, because Lezak played an active role in the community in dealing in I would say keeping the peace isn't quite the right thing, but avoiding violent confrontations. He used to say the People's Somebody Army came and sat in the office all day once, and the question was to throw him out or what to do. And he said, this is a public office. If they sit here in first place, there'd be 100 of them would come to the door down below. And he would say, no, select your leader, or maybe two, not more than three, and I will be glad to meet with them. We consider that you are making a grievance, as the Constitution permits the citizens to file a grievance and make a grievance, assemble to make agreements against his government. And if you have that grievance, we will take it and see that it gets to the right people who can act on it or take action with regard to it. And if you want to, if your leaders want to sit in our office, at public office, they may do so until 5 o'clock when it will close. When it will close, they will have to leave. If they will not leave, then we will have you removed. These fine lines, you see, the courthouse was exclusive, but the public sidewalk was still the city. And so things could happen on the public sidewalk where if they crossed the line into onto the exclusively federal side of it, then the federal side of it might have to respond. So they would often walk on the sidewalk, being careful not to step into or upon the exclusively federal jurisdiction. These enormous number of fine lines and technical things arose. It would go on. Then they went to Canada. What to do about their coming back and the amnesty program. And we washed out 400 or 500 cases on the amnesty program, just like that.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually the statute ran. And eventually the boards came to an end, and we washed out hundreds and hundreds of those cases, and just closed them. And that came to an end. Now, while this unrest, the civil unrest was going on, there were other violent things that occurred. And that's something of another whole story in itself. Because you see, they smashed all, the Johnson Hall was bombed down at the University of Oregon, from some destruction. The Marine Recruiting Center down there was bombed and substantially destroyed. The all the windows of the gymnasium on one side, on that street that runs north and south along the gym, were busted one night. The OBA, you see, Charlie Turner was the assistant. OBA had with the teaching assistant, which Armsbury, which Christine Olson prosecuted as an assistant. She is now the United States Attorney. I mean, taking an interim of some years, the teaching assistant who, with OBA, set up some of the bombs in his basement with Richard OBA, and the dynamite that was related to all of that. And then the group that I prosecuted here, some of them, the White Panthers, who came out of Sullivan's Gulch, which is over on the east side, and through the Molotov cocktail through the window of the Selective Service headquarters over there. It's now this, where the state office building is, one night. And Richard Yapel, who was the head of the White Panthers. And for that matter, the Black Panthers, who marched together, a dozen of them or so at most, down in Eugene, and caused all kinds of problems down there. And those, the violence of the dissent with the war and later the civil rights movement, the suicide of the president of the University of Oregon, who was driving his truck, and or his car, his VW car, and had a head-on collision with a log truck. Maybe that's what it was. Most people don't think so. Think that the dissent, the violence had become so great in Eugene and his inability to resolve it because of the bigger questions really was the cause of his death. There's a book about that, Confrontation, it's called, and about the death of the president of the University of Oregon. We saw this, the draft and the war, the draft problems were of, there's a whole technical nature that relates to the boards and the records and the so forth. There is the violence, which we saw, and in which there were criminal charges, not just Gwether and Morgan, but the bombings themselves. There was many people think that in Lebanon. There's a Willamette Industries plant, and that there was a guard and late at night, about midnight, and he was shot with an M1 rifle and killed. And McCall ordered the whole police department, state police, to attempt. They never solved that murder. Some people think that it may have been related to anti-war efforts, although we don't know. A very difficult time, because you had all the selective service problems, then you had the violence problems on top of it, and in various shades and forms. I mean, the Symbionese Liberation Army of Patty Hearst grows out of some of this. Well, that's down there, you say. Well, no. The White Panthers were up here, and there were other violent groups forming and resisting the war in one way or another. And then, you know, the Kennedys are killed. I remember the day Jack Kennedy was killed in November of 1963. I had only been on the job a couple of months, and I was sitting at the window on the next to Lezak's office, in that small office on the fifth floor, and looking out and watching the flag was lowered on the Multnomah County Courthouse that afternoon. Was the end of an era. Regardless of all the sensational materials, regardless of all the sensational materials since, that was a devastating event when Kennedy was shot. We got the word over the radio as it occurred, and there was a sense of panic. You weren't quite sure what was going to happen next, and many people were concerned that this was not an isolated instance. And the law enforcement agencies went on a semi-alert that there might well be more that might happen. Later, of course, with Martin Luther King's death, and then Robert Kennedy's death, of course, with Martin Luther's King's death, there was that event where Robert Kennedy gave the greatest speech of his life at Indianapolis, where he heard, as he was going to make the speech of the death of Martin Luther King, and he was urged not to speak, and did, and gave a great, remarkable speech. And part of it was that he knew about this. Mm-hmm. And without saying it, of course, referring to the reference to his brother, and kept that crowd from just tearing the place apart, as occurred elsewhere. The staggering days, because there was real, you began to wonder if the country wasn't going to come apart. And here we were, assistant U.S. attorneys, the United States attorney, concerned about keeping it together. And the draft cases, and we've talked about a few of the more spectacular ones, there were the humorous sides to it, as of Lance Montauk and his paint. But there were the very tragic sides of the people who weren't very bright and were being drafted, and that was was Robert Hinkle, the marginal fellow who the army, who had been in the army and then went home, and the army went and picked him up, and he got a couple of lawyers, and they brought a habeas corpus action. I'd never had a habeas corpus action. And we had a hearing. This marginal mental, you see, enough to get in the army, couldn't read well at all. And there was a very understanding colonel who came down from Fort Lewis, who understood the difficulties that we were having, putting a guy in the army who couldn't read, and said, and it was very, very good, but said, you know, the army's taught lots of people to read. And of course he was right, Army has been a social force in educating people and teaching them to read and write and everything else, so that just because he wasn't a good reader didn't mean that they couldn't make a good soldier.
Right.
And he eventually went off to the army. That was the Hinkle case, which was it was dramatic in the sense that the army is kidnapping this boy from his mother's bed up in St. Helens and so forth. But there was some more to it. And he's back there now. And every once in a while I see a little note in the paper of Robert Hinkle, not doing particularly well, I gather. But he said that he and the army's paths crossed rather dramatically at one point in all this. And these kinds of cases arose all over the place. I don't know where we want to leave Vietnam. Vietnam isn't over yet.
Shall we pick it up next time? It looks like.
Well, maybe. Let me think about Vietnam. Okay. Vietnam is a hard question because, for different reasons, very different reasons, Lezak and I and Charlie Turner and Hawk, for that matter, come out about the same place. Namely, that the law ought to be enforced. That's what we were hired to do, and that's what we're about. And Lezak would say, yes, and in what manner? And Turner would say, let's get to work. And Hawk would be down on Sunday in San Francisco handling 100 draft cases. Colonel Eichstadt, that was his name, Colonel Eichstadt, remarkable guy, had 9 children. And he was the one who made those boards, who got this record, was the support system, and got the records together for that enormous defense of the judicial system, because that is exactly how Gus Solomon saw it. And he was not going to have the system come down while he could still try cases. And well, one can argue about this one way or the other. He sent people to prison for their draft evasion, the same way he sent white-collar criminals to prison for tax evasion. His position was that they are, the white-collar criminals, for the most, are the, and have the benefits of the society in an inordinate degree by comparison with others, and that they had a responsibility to do it and to cheat in that fashion. You wouldn't stand for it. Which was interesting, because many of other judges, not so many here, but other places, felt very differently about tax evasion. It was a slap on the wrist.
Right.
Yes, next time, let me think about where we ought to go next time, because there are some other, you haven't heard about D.B. Cooper yet.
No, he's on my list.
Yes, well, D.B. is fun. And my involvement in it is kind of fun. It comes in kind of back through the back door, but you see maybe have we got time to tell you one more case that isn't in the paper?
Sure.
That was something I was really quite proud of.
Let's turn this over because I think.